computer.
No, but where is she?
So book is my purse, and it's right next to.
You know, should I bring that in next morning and then just?
That's great.
I don't know.
I can't tell, is it recording?
Yeah.
The light is on.
It's on.
Okay.
Yeah, if the light's on, it's on.
Okay, I didn't know if it had flash.
Thank you. Okay. Well, it's hard to believe this is our last class for this part of the course, at least. So anyone who wants to quickly remind me of some of the things we discussed last week?
Stern Gang.
The Stern Gang, also known as Lehi in Hebrew, named after Yaakov Stern, who was murdered by the British police, we believe. Or maybe he was killed trying to escape and jumped out the window and, you know, all by himself. There's millions of stories as to how it happened. We also talked about the Saison. Anybody remember that? That's very significant. That'll come into play tonight.
Jew against Jew.
Jew against Jew.
Civil War.
Basically, it was Civil War. But remember, Begin gets some credit for telling the Irgun not to fight back. And that puts him in good stead, and that'll make something possible this evening. We talked about World War II in general, and we talked about the potential invasions. Right? There were three potential invasions. Remember, they were afraid of the Italians. The Italians had bombed Tel Aviv and Haifa and Jerusalem. We talked about the concern with the Vichy French in the north in Syria and Lebanon, that they might come down, and the Haganah was actually recruited by the British to go fight the Vichy French. And then we talked about Rommel coming across from the east, but he was stopped at El Alamein. And we talked about the what was it called? It wasn't the Masada complex. It was the Carmel plan, where they were going to maybe hole up around the Carmel as the British evacuated.
In the caves.
So there was some scary stuff going on, particularly in the early days of World War II. And, you know, nothing was a guarantee. And all along, there was skirmishing with the Arabs. And it's going to get a lot more serious tonight. Because these are the years that were really a tremendous amount of action from 1945 to 48, because these are the years that are leading up to statehood, and everybody's trying to literally get their feet on certain ground so they're in good position to do what they need to do when the state comes. And there's no guarantee the state's going to come until the last moment anyway. All right, so World War II, just as World War I did, changed the yeshuv pretty significantly. For starters, at least for the Jews, and really for everybody, I should say, emotions were very, very high. You know, tens of millions had been killed in the war. Actually, I don't know, I think 20 million total were killed in World War II. With 6 million Jews, obviously, a tremendous amount of Russians, tremendous amount of Germans, and so on and so on, tremendous amount of Poles that weren't Jews. Over in the Yeshuv, people were more militarized than ever. The Haganah had certain experience fighting with the British. We had up to 26,000 people in the Yeshuv volunteered in the British Army, which was going to hold them in great stead. And that, by the way, was going to be a significant factor in the independence war. The Arabs didn't do that. Remember, they always kept themselves at distance, to be kind, from the British forces. And also, the Haganah and the Palmach were now part of daily life. Basically, if you were between the ages of 16 and 35, you were part of the Haganah or Palmach or Irgun or maybe the Lehi. The Palmach had 20,000, 25,000, not the Palmach, the Haganah had 20,000, 25,000 people around this time. The Irgun had about 2,000 people. Lehi or the Stern Gang had between 500 and 1,000, depending on what period you're talking about. So the leadership of the Yeshuv after the war makes a critical decision. It decides that if in the beginning of the war we first said we were going to fight the white papers if there were no war and the wars if there were no white paper. Well, in truth, what they did is they decided to fight the war. And there was illegal immigration, but it was nothing compared to the scale that it was about to take. What really happened is they decided to go full force of fighting the white paper once again. And that was going to make a lot of things possible. For their part, the Brits are increasingly frustrated in Palestine. But they want to hold on to Palestine. It's very important to hold on to the Suez Canal. They're still in India. This is 45. The picture's going to change in 47, 48 for them. They also still want the Kirkuk to Haifa pipeline for their Mediterranean fleet, which is what the Italians were trying to bomb. They still want to best the French in the colonial game. And they still want to be number one in the world, even though they increasingly know they can't, because That's the role of the United States now. The United States emerges as the superpower. So the Americans are the superpower, and David Ben-Gurion recognizes this during the war. We actually talked a little bit about that last week when we said that he wanted the Zionist conference called the Biltmore Conference to be in the United States so that the Americans would hear it and understand the power of the Zionist movement. There was a lot of confidence in America. Americans had participated in the war. Americans had always been seen as friendly toward the Zionist movement. We didn't know then what we know now about Roosevelt and some of the communications that have come out. The Arabs, however, had little or no change. They were as intransigent as ever. They weren't cooperating with the British. And yet the British continued to reach out to them because of their holdings in the rest of the Arab world. And remember, the British were in control or had troops in Jordan, and they controlled the Canal Zone, they controlled or had troops in Iraq, so there was a significant stake at hand for the British. So I said everyone had gotten radical, and no one was more radical for the American Jews than Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver. Has anyone ever heard of Rabbi Silver? What do you know about him? Anything in particular?
Well, I know about him in the context of the lobby for support or recognition of the State of Israel. And
yeah, he was the guy.
With Truman and his playoff with Stephen Wise, and he was considered more aggressive and critical of Roosevelt.
Right, Roosevelt and then Truman.
Right,
because remember, Truman comes into office in early in 45. Anyone else know anything else about Rabbi Silver? But his biographer, Mark Lee Raphael, said people found him, quote, arrogant, overbearing, domineering, egotistical, contemptuous, and an enemy of anyone who dared oppose him or one of his ideas.
Otherwise, he was a nice guy.
Yeah. Outside of that, you know.
A typical ideologue.
Yeah. He was not an easy person to live with, but he was the person that you wanted on your side if you had a cause that needed defending with zealous energy. So he was bombastic and oratorical in style. He could be long-winded. He had an in-your-face diplomacy, and he didn't win friends in the high places. He fought with Stephen Wise, who
Where's
was now... he's from New York City, and he went to Cleveland. He went to the synagogue in Cleveland. He stayed there. I have it in a minute. We'll go. It's something like 40, 46 years or something like that. It was a very, very reformed congregation when he first got there. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise was now an older gentleman. He was the one who was the confidant of Roosevelt, meaning Roosevelt would always let him come see him when he wanted to. But Wise didn't get that much done in many regards. Not the way someone like Silver, with his agenda of aggressiveness, would do. But his mood fit the moment because everybody was radicalized. Let me give you some biographical facts about Silver. He was born in 1893 and he lived till 1963. He was born in Lithuania, actually. He was came to this country when he was 9. He was the son and grandson of Orthodox rabbis, so he had tradition in his background, and he was raised in a traditional home. He came to Zionism very early. He first spoke at a Zionist meeting in New York City at the age of 14. He became president of the Herzl Zionist Club, which was dedicated to speaking Hebrew to debate Jewish issues of the day. So he was fluent in Hebrew, he was a young intellectual ideologue, but yet he was captivated by Reform Judaism and the Americanism of it. And remember, at that point, Zionism was not a major factor, quite the opposite, in Reform Judaism. He was going to be one of these people that was going to change that in entirety. So he went to Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, which was the hotbed of classical reform. He was the valedictorian of his class. He became rabbi in the bustling metropolis of Wheeling, West Virginia for a few years. Anyone ever been to Wheeling?
Mm-hmm.
That's lovely.
I've been to West Virginia.
Well, I've been to Harper's Ferry, been to West Virginia. That's not West Virginia. In 1917, he was age 24. He became the rabbi of the temple. There's a number of reform congregations around the city that are called that are called The Temple. There's one in Atlanta, too. If you saw the movie Driving Miss Daisy, that's The Temple. It actually is called the Hebrew Benevolent Congregation, but everybody there just calls it The Temple. Bit ostentatious, center of the world, and indeed that's how some of the congregants at least saw themselves. It was so reformed that at one point it celebrated Shabbat on Sunday. Remember, we talked about reform when it developed. One of the things that it attempted to do was kind of be a Jewish sense of Protestantism, particularly in Germany, but some of that spilled over to here. He was an early advocate for social causes, labor rights, workmen's comp issues, but his commitment to Zionism was the number one thing that really captured his attention. He actually, however, was a cultural Zionist at first. He wasn't an in-your-face political Zionist. He told a skeptical hiring committee that he favored a spiritual and cultural center in Palestine that would galvanize Jewish life the world over. And he said, the political thrust of Zionism for me is secondary. So, not so much what he would become. He was an organizational man. You know, these certain people come along and all they do is they bounce from organization to organization doing great things in each place. So listen to this. He was a founder and co-chair of the United Jewish Appeals. He was president of the United Palestine Appeal. He was representative of the American Zionist Movement at various Zionist congresses. He was a president of the Zionist Organization of America, and he was the president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. So he ate a lot of rubber chicken.
A busy guy.
He ate a lot of rubber chicken. He was also relentless in his pursuit of, we're talking about Abba Hillel Silver. He was also relentless in his pursuit of good ties between the U.S. and the Yishuv or the State of Israel. He was radicalized, like many other people, by the World War II and the Holocaust. There was this tremendous outpouring of emotions for the displaced persons, the refugees after the war. Part of this came from the guilt factor of, did we do enough to help them? Which is, you know, definitely part of the factor of what's going on. He had a stormy relationship with President Truman. There is a story, and I, you know, some people cite it as true and some people say it's apocryphal, so I don't know, where a Zionist delegation was in to meet with Truman, and Abba Hillel Silver didn't like the answer he was getting, so he rapped on the president's desk and said, no, this is what we need. Now, if you know anything about Harry Truman, that wasn't the smartest idea. And indeed, we got to the point where Truman wouldn't allow any Zionists to come into his office, particularly Abba Hillel Silver, at a very critical moment. And we're going to get to that in a few minutes, too. Meanwhile, not helping him with Truman either was he was openly identified with the Republican Party, whom he pressed to have a pro-Zionist plank in its platform in 1944 and 1948. Truman didn't like that either, because Truman truly didn't like being put into a box. He was a very cantankerous individual. Yes, sir?
What was the connection to the Republican Party? Why?
He was just a Republican. I mean, he liked their philosophies.
Well, he thought Roosevelt hadn't done enough, had let the Jews down, and he thought Dewey was going to be more aggressive.
He thought Dewey was going to be aggressive, but he was a Republican before World War II. And Truman knew, everybody knew from about 46 on that Truman was going to be in a very close race. So Truman wasn't a big fan, to say the least. I don't know what particular social policy or whatever it was at that time. Meanwhile, the British Labour Party is back in power after World War II. Remember, Churchill is this great hero to the Western world, and he's bounced out of office in the summer of 1945. It's simply time for a change. The Zionists are excited because in opposition, the Labour Party had been very pro-Zionist. They had a pro-Zionist plank in their platform. When they got to office, they reneged on all this, which is not unusual in politics. They said that the Jewish population should be no more than one-third of the total, and the white paper restrictions will continue to stay in place. Now remember, the white paper is 75,000 immigration, 5 years, 15,000 a year, which they didn't implement during World War II, by the way. They didn't live up to that 75,000, and no more land sales to Jews. Jews are always going to be a minority in the country, and eventually we want to have a constituent assembly which is representative, which is going to rule the country, which is bad for the Jews because they're only going to be one-third of the country, and we can imagine what's going to happen. Palestine is in turmoil. There are now between 80,000 to 100,000 British troops patrolling Palestine. They had a few hundred when they first took over the country for good in 1918, 1919. Things have gotten bad. There are stepped up arrests of Irgun and Haganah leaders. There's low-scale civil war, there's low-scale guerrilla warfare going on between the Jewish groups and the British. Now, this is an interesting twist. Basically, the frustration of the Jews at the Labor Party leads to the Haganah and the Irgun, which had been mortal enemies about a year earlier, uniting for a Jewish resistance movement under the leadership of the Haganah. This was October 1945. And Lehi was in this as well, which is really surprising because, frankly, they're out-and-out terrorists. We saw they're the ones that assassinated Lord Moyne in Cairo, the British High Commissioner, I can't remember his exact title, but he was in charge of policy for all of the Near East. What they said, the reason making this possible was the disputes that we have, which are real, are nothing when compared to the issue of immigration and what the Holocaust did to our people. So we're going to put all this aside and we're going to work on our common enemy, which is the British. So now we have in 42, we've declared that the goal of the movement is a state. And now in 45, we're uniting all our armed factions, which still aren't, you know, sizable military factions, but they're very good, well-coordinated guerrilla bodies. They can't fight a major war by any stretch. They carried out 11 major operations and many, many smaller ones. They included attacks on train lines, police stations, and the bombing of government offices. So the British never knew where they were going to be hit next. So this is a big change from what was going on during World War II, when we had Ben-Gurion directing the Haganah to hunt down the people in the Irgun. And there was a general sense of peace. Their first action together came on October 1945 in a Palmach-led raid on the Atlit Detention Center. They liberated 208 illegal immigrants who had been taken from one of the ships that had come in. One of the more spectacular attacks came on June 15th and 16th, 1946. This is called the Night of the Bridges. Anyone ever heard of that?
Heard of it.
Yeah, Leila Gisharim, Night of the Bridges. They targeted 11 bridges that link Palestine to Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. So simultaneously, they attacked these 11 bridges, and the goal was to stop both British transportation from moving around, as well as Arab irregulars from coming into the country and launching raids. The goal was to damage the British prestige and to show that they were a force that was capable of doing something. They launched 50 ambushes and attacks in small ones in other areas just before this as a diversion. So the British would draw forces away from certain areas and not know what was going on. Only one bridge was failed to be blown up. So the British were immobilized temporarily. And if we had our projector here, I would show you a picture of that, one of those bridges. But it's not your fault. It's not your fault. But I'm still going to send it to Michelle to post everything so you guys can look at that. So this angered the British. This led them to something called Operation Agatha. I don't know why they called it Agatha. On June 29th, it was also called Black Sabbath, not the rock group by the same name, or the Jewish one Black Shabbos, if you've ever heard them. This is because they started on Shabbat. 17,000 British soldiers participated in this. They fanned the country. They arrested 2,700 Jews, including many Haganah leaders. They put them in internment camps. They used low-flying planes, roadblocks. They flagged down trains. They put curfews out. They were signaling to the Yishuv that we've had it. You know, we're not going to take this anymore. And they found what they were looking for. Listen to this. At Kibbutz Yagur, they found 300 2-inch mortars, 400,000 bullets, 5,000 grenades, 78 revolvers, and all men of the kibbutz were arrested. So they weren't playing around anymore. Now, this was a very particularly ugly confrontation, but symbolic of what was going on around the country. Some people were herded into the cages, and they were screaming, "This is what the Nazis did to us. How dare you do this to us?" Some women ripped their clothing to show their Holocaust, you know, tattoos. It shook some of the British soldiers, but nonetheless, they continued onward. At the Jewish agency offices in Jerusalem, they carted away 3 truckloads worth of papers. And as they sifted through it in their intelligence headquarters or offices at the King David Hotel, they found material linking the Jewish Agency to the United Jewish Resistance Movement. So this was a big problem for the Jewish Agency, to say the least, because they had continually been washing their hands, saying we're not responsible for any of this. So the Haganah then did something very interesting. This is the part that we often don't hear about. They sent a letter. Moshe Sneh, whose son Ephraim would go on to be an important cabinet minister in the Rabin and Peres administrations, Moshe Sneh, who was head of the Haganah, sent a letter to the Irgun saying, please step up plans for that attack on the King David Hotel. This was actually a Haganah sanctioned, if not ordered, attack. The Irgun came up with the idea initially. You guys have been to the King David Hotel, mm-hmm. most of you? Mm-hmm. You've seen it? It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. It was built in 1931. It was financed by Egyptian Jews. It's 7 stories. The British had requisitioned about 1/3 of the building for its headquarters, for its administrative offices in Palestine, including the intelligence office, including the military office. So what the Irgun did is they stepped up surveillance. They planned to ambush an Arab milk truck, which would be delivering milk cans to the restaurant on the bottom floor there. And they killed them. I don't know if you saw, I can't remember if we saw the video. I've seen so many videos for this course, and the man who was talking about that, when he was talking about the Irgun. Maybe not. Did we see that? Yeah, he was standing on the beach. Mm-hmm. Say it again?
No, I think so. We saw something about King David Hotel.
Yeah, that was when we were, because from when we were talking about the Irgun. Like I said, I've screened so many of these, I don't know which we've seen anymore. So they ambushed these guys. They put on Arab clothing. They went into the hotel. They unloaded, a weapon. Jars which were filled with explosives. I thought I had the weight on here. They entered through the basement. They overcame some guards. There was some light arms fire exchange, but they got out. And then they signaled to 2 Irgun women who were standing outside to call, make 3 calls, to call the hotel, to call the French consulate, which was next door, and to call the Palestine Post, which is the Jerusalem Post. And this is what they said. I'm speaking on behalf of the Hebrew Underground. We have placed an explosive device in the King David Hotel, evacuated it at once. You have been warned. Menachem Begin verifies in his autobiography that those calls went out. The British dispute it. Although in later years, one of the British soldiers has come out and said that that call actually was made to the hotel. Begin claimed he wanted the hotel to be evacuated so civilians wouldn't be injured. What the British said was no one, quote, in an official position with any power to take action, received the call. So an operator received the call and didn't pass it on. We'll never know the truth. That's the only truth that we know right now. They wanted to destroy the intelligence offices which had the papers. Mitch, you raise your hand? Or?
Yeah. So in prior attacks, like the Night of the Bridges, were there military/civilians killed in those operations?
There were the military killed in the attack, in the bridges attack in particular, because there were sentries posted at the bridges. Sometimes there were civilians killed, but they tried not to do that. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. In this particular attack, 91 people were killed, and I can't remember. Here it is. Only 28 of them were British. They were going to actually detonated a small explosive outside of the King David Hotel, which was meant to keep people away. They figured, you know, explosive goes off, people go away. You've been to Israel, guess what happens?
People congregate,
and some of those people, unfortunately, were killed. They congregate to see what's going on. So at 12:37, here's a 770-pound bomb with 6 charges exploded. It collapsed the southern wing of the hotel. Some of you might have seen the picture of that collapse. It's stunning when you look at it and think of the hotel today. 91 people were killed, 41 Arabs, 28 Brits, and 17 Jews, and 46 more were injured. Rescue crews removed 2,000 truckloads of debris over the, in the coming weeks from the area.
Trucks were smaller back then.
Yeah, I don't know. In going through the rubble, the British troops found 6 survivors, which is, you know, when we think of 911 and we think of that, and, you know, think of a similar scene, obviously on a very different scale. The Haganah, meanwhile, told the Irgun that the attack should have occurred later in the day to minimize casualties. The Irgun was branded a terrorist group by the Jewish Agency. The Jewish Agency said they had, quote, feelings of horror at the base and unparalleled act perpetuated today by a gang of criminals. Remember, Ben-Gurion hated Menachem Begin, and he never had anything good to say about the Irgun. He was in Paris, and he declared the Irgun was, quote, the enemy of the Jewish people. This is not so good for your United Jewish Resistance movement. Begin said in response, I was operating on a letter from the headquarters of the United Resistance demanding that we carry out an attack on the center of government at the King David Hotel as soon as possible. And then the Irgun radio added, we mourn the Jewish victims. They too are the tragic victims of the tragic and noble Hebrew War of Liberation. Now, he refused to mourn the Brits because he said they refused to mourn the Holocaust. So he was, you know, that way till the end on this issue. And including when he was prime minister, it became an issue when Begin had to make state visits to England. I remember the first time there was a new series of articles that came up, the man's a terrorist, should we allow him in, and what have you. So it was a diplomatic row about it. After the bombing, Weizmann urged the Jewish Agency to call off the Jewish resistance movement, Unity, and that's indeed what happened. Weizmann was losing power from afar, but he still had some sway and influence as the old man of the movement. So it lasted for 10 months, and it was an important chapter in the leading up to the state, because at a minimum it showed that these groups actually could cooperate together, and that was going to become very important in 1948 and ultimately in late 48, 49 when the Irgun would disband and meld into the Israel Defense Forces. All right, a postscript to the bombing. General Evelyn Barker was the head of the British troops in Palestine. He said, and this did not win him any friends in the Jewish community, all Jewish places of entertainment, cafes, restaurants, shops, and private dwellings are off limits to British soldiers. I appreciate that these measures will inflict some hardship on the troops, but I'm certain that if my reasons are fully explained to them, they will understand their propriety, and they will be punishing the Jews in the way the race dislikes as much as any by striking at their pockets and showing our contempt for them. Nice guy. Nice guy. There was a howl of protest, and 2 weeks later, those orders were rescinded. I mean, remember, this is coming months after the Holocaust, not years after the Holocaust. There's still sizable sympathy for the Jewish people and the displaced persons issue, which we're going to get to in a moment. One other controversial moment to give some mention to is something called the Sergeant's Affair, which took place in July 1947. And this was an Irgun operation from start to end, and it's a, you know, very unpleasant affair. So using a stolen taxi cab, the British, the Irgun kidnapped 2 British soldiers, 2 sergeants. Turns out they were in a cafe in Nahariya. They used chloroform to grab them as they were walking out of a cafe. The British soldiers were defying their orders. They were supposed to be in groups of 4. These weren't groups of 2. They weren't supposed to be out this late at night in this certain area. So they violated regulations. The Irgun threatened to kill them if the 3 Irgun members being held by the British that were scheduled to be executed were actually executed, were hanged. The British would hang people as a death sentence. You kill British soldiers, you know, that's the fate you're going to get. The Jewish Agency, not surprisingly, agreed to cooperate for the search for the sergeants. The Haganah set out to find them, just as they set out to hunt down the Irgun members in the Saison in 1944. The British searched high and low. They also went ahead with their execution of the 3 Irgunniks. So it was getting ugly. They were hanged to death while singing HaTikvah. The two sergeants were hanged to death in response. They were hanged from adjacent trees, and landmines were put underneath them so that if they were cut down or someone came to rescue them, they would be exploded as well. Fortunately, the Haganah found out about that and let the Brits know about that, so they were able to defuse that situation, although when one of the bodies was cut down, unfortunately, it exploded. But no one else was injured. This all prompted a very ugly response by the British soldiers. On the evening of July 31st, they went on a bit of a rampage in Palestine. They broke shop windows and assaulted people. Groups of young Jews took to the streets and started stoning the police, who withdrew. The police came back with six armored vehicles. They opened fire and they killed five Jews and injured three more. Things were getting out of control in Palestine. This was no longer a situation where the Jews were looking for protection from the Brits as they built their national home, thanks to His Majesty's government. There was also anti-Jewish rioting in England. A wooden synagogue in Glasgow, Scotland was burned down. Bricks were thrown through the windows of Jewish-owned shops in Liverpool. Bomb threats were phoned into synagogues in London, and Jewish graves were defaced. Which, to me, was fascinating because it was an early example of showing how what happens in Israel links the diaspora, whether or not the diaspora likes it. And that's one of the arguments I often make to young people. You don't have to worry about what Israel does. It'll catch up to you sooner or later anyway, if you stay identified as a Jew. It's always an interesting conversation to have. Meanwhile, illegal immigration continued. And the greatest story of illegal immigration was the Exodus. And where did it sail from? Bomber! It was the
Warfield,
the USS President Warfield, actually. And which was, it was a 1927 ship built for the Baltimore Steam Packet Company. On November 9th, 1946, the Haganah bought it. Now, the Haganah really liked this ship. It wasn't in the greatest of shape, but it was a strong ship. It was made out of steel. It was going to be difficult to ram. It was large enough that it could probably sail the high seas. Most of the ships that the illegal immigration, Mossad al-Aliyah Bet, used weren't as seaworthy as one would like by any stretch of the imagination. And most importantly, it would carry 4,515 people. This was going to be a major operation. You know, that's a whole heck of a lot of illegal immigrants. And by the way, you know, the Jews knew that they basically weren't going to be able to hide a ship like that. It was going to be caught, but it was going to be seen by journalists. And it just so happened that when they came to Palestine, they were there when a UN commission called the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine was investigating how to create states that would survive for the Jews and the Arabs. It was renamed the Exodus 1947 and left Baltimore on February 25th, 1947. I assume everybody's seen the movie?
Okay.
Paul Newman, right. My favorite scene in that movie is when a British soldier says to Paul Newman, "I can spot a Jew a mile away." Yeah. And he goes, "I have something in my eye. Can you tell me?" No, oh, must be gone. Thank you very much.
I think Barry Lever made a documentary.
I wouldn't be surprised if Barry made it, because the Jewish Museum had an exhibit on it, so he might have done it in conjunction with that.
I think there may be a plaque at the World Trade Center.
There is, actually.
Yeah.
There is, actually. That's,
yes,
I get.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, yes.
The real.
Leon Uris was from Baltimore. I don't know what, if that's the impetus that got him to write the book. Leon Uris is a great storyteller, but not a great writer. So, you know, that's always the rap on him. He's got another book, by the way, called The Hajj, which is worth looking at, which is the Arab-Israeli stuff through the perspective of an Arab character. It's just H-A-J, the Hajj, which is the honorific title if you go to Mecca, Medina, like the Hajj Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem. All right, back to the Exodus. It loaded up its people near Marseille, France. The British knew what this ship was up to. It had a ship trail the Exodus, or shadow the Exodus. It had an airplane flying overhead, watching it. The people on the Exodus transmitted that they were going to Turkey, of all places. But when they got out to sea, they revealed their real colors. Exodus 19:47, and there's a big sign on the side that says Yitziat Me'Europa, exiting Europe. But conditions on the boat, by the way, weren't great. They weren't horrible, but I wish you could see the picture. There are a lot of people crowded onto this boat. They put barbed wire around the bottom hole because they knew the British were going to try and board it. They didn't think the British were going to ram it, but they certainly thought they were going to put smaller ships up on the side. So 20 miles from the Palestinian shore, the British did try and board it. And it was somewhat of a pitched battle without weapons, although there were people who were injured because the British were using batons. And they weapons were used. Two passengers died of gunshots. 10 were treated for injuries. The decision was made to take the ship back to France. Now, this was very controversial. It was being captured by the media all the while because they brought it closer into shore. And what they did is they disembarked people who would get off easily at first, the women and the children. Then they had to drag a lot of the men off. And they put them on smaller, more seaworthy boats. And they were going to sail them back to France. And then the debate was, once we get them to France, what are we going to do from there? So the decision was made, once we finally get back to France, that we're going to send them to Germany, to internment camps there. So you can imagine how this played in the world press. Here are these refugees, survived the Holocaust, go in this rickety boat across the seas to Palestine, which is their dream, and now you're sending them back to Germany. You know, come on. And you're putting them in the British zone in Germany. So a British diplomat in France, John Coulson, summed it up this way in a note to the Foreign Office. And that this became a PR nightmare for the Brits, which is exactly what the Zionists wanted from the start. You will realize that an announcement of decision to send immigrants back to Germany will produce violent, hostile outbursts in the press. There is one point that should be kept in mind. Our opponents in France and I dare say in other countries have made great play with the fact that these immigrants were being kept behind barbed wire in concentration camps and guarded by Germans. If we decide it is convenient not to keep them in camps any longer, I suggest that we should make some play that we are releasing them from all restraint of this kind in accordance with their wishes, and that they were only put in such accommodation for the preliminary necessities of screening and maintenance. So this is the subtle British diplomatic way of saying, we need an out here. British didn't do that. Dr. Noah Baron of the British section of the World Jewish Congress filed this report when they got to Germany. The British soldiers went into the operation as a football match, and it seemed evident that they had not had it explained to them that they were dealing with people who had suffered a lot and who were resisting in accordance with their convictions. People were usually hit in the stomach, and this is my opinion, explains that many people who did not show any signs of injury were staggering and moving very slowly along the staircase, giving the impression that they were half-starved and beaten up. When the people walked off the ship, many of them, especially younger people, were shouting to the troops, "Hitler commandos, gentlemen fascists, sadists." So again, they hadn't achieved their goal of getting to Palestine, but they did achieve another macro goal, which is embarrassing the British. And this was putting increasing pressure on the British. The good news is a majority of these people were smuggled into the American zone, and from there they tried again to make their way to Palestine. Indeed, by the time Israel was declared, there were only, 1,800 of these original 4,500 or so people were still in the British concentration, old British camps. I don't want to call them concentration camps because these weren't particularly concentration camps. Did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. Any questions? I've been talking a lot. Okay. All right. Meanwhile, a series of diplomatic maneuvers were beginning after the war. Guess what the British thought it was a good idea to do?
Get out.
Have a commission. You know, because that's what they did, right? Remember, they had 7 commissions from 1922 to 1947. There was a tremendous amount of pressure on the Brits to allow 100,000 refugees into Palestine. For some reason, this number seemed to be magic. And President Truman...
This was the U.S.
President Truman latched on this number, but I'm not sure why they said 100,000.
It was a round number.
Because, well, there were 250,000 total in the DP camps. So we're not sure why it was 100,000. But the Brits really were not happy about this at all. They saw it as meddling. And they also said, if we let 100,000 more people into the country, we're going to need at least 100,000 more troops to patrol this country, Palestine. And, you know, of course, the Prime Minister of Britain in a... inopportune moment, let it slip that the only reason why Truman wanted this to happen is because he didn't want that many more Jews in New York City. No, Bevin was the foreign minister. Anthony Eden. Yeah, Attlee was earlier. Anthony Eden. Bevin was no piece of... Bevin was no Rugalach either.
Right.
You know, let's put it that way. All right, so what they decided was they're going to have something called the Anglo-American Commission, Committee of Inquiry. Eden said, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, if the recommendations of this committee are unanimous, I will adhere to them. He was lying, because we're going to see that they were unanimous and he didn't adhere to them. All right, they formed on January 4th, 1946, and the goal was to find a way to deal with the refugees and maybe even to look at the broader issue of what to do with the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs as well. Like all the other commissions and committees that we've looked at so far, they went to Palestine, they met with Arabs and Jews, they met with other leading Arabs, they met with Weizmann over in Europe, they took notes, they wrote up the paper, so they went to Washington, they went to London, they visited DP camps. They put out a report on April 20th, 1946, and they agreed, yes, 100,000 refugees should be allowed into Palestine immediately.
Hitler's birthday.
April 20th, that is correct. That is correct. They also, which is fitting in many regards, they also recommended a single state. They wanted a binational state, which, as you remember, our folks from the Ichud, the movement for a binational state, wanted Martin Buber and Judah Magnus. They said, quote, the Jew shall not dominate Arab, and Arab shall not dominate Jew in Palestine, that Palestine shall be neither a Jewish state nor an Arab state, that the form of government ultimately to be established shall, under international guarantees, fully protect and preserve the interests in the Holy Land of Christendom and of the Muslim and of the Jewish faiths. President Truman quickly endorsed this. It was, of course, unworkable. And Prime Minister Eden quickly said, I don't think it's a good idea. It's not realistic because we're going to be the ones stuck with that. So what do you do when you have that? You put together another committee to implement the recommendations. This is the finest of British policymaking. This is the Morrison-Grady Committee. Morrison was a British politician. Grady was an American diplomat. So this, we're up to July 46. And this process, you're going to see, quickly leads us to the State of Israel itself. July 46, their proposed plan had Jewish and Arab self-rule with British oversight. So again, short on details, good on the big ideas. Jerusalem and the Negev were going to stay under British control. Remember, the Negev is close to the Suez Canal. So that's important to the British. February 14th, the British foreign... So February 47 now, that was July 46, the British propose a five-year trusteeship that they'll have of the land. Both the Arabs and Jews rejected it. So then we get to February 14th, 1947, and Foreign Minister Bevin announces, we can't do this. We can't do this anymore. We're giving this over to the United Nations to solve. Now, there's a lot of talk that the reason why Bevin and the Brits gave this to the United Nations was because the United Nations would come back and say, you know, we can't figure this out anyway. Would you continue your mandate? And that would give the Brits more leeway to do what they wanted to do, to implement whatever measures they wanted to implement. And then they would maintain their prestige. They would be in a stronger position in the international community. So the UN created something called the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, or UNSCOP. And the goal that was created on May 15, 1947. And UNSCOP's goal was to figure out what to do once and for all. Remember, we had the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And since 1922, when we had the Churchill White Paper, which chunked off Transjordan, later to be Jordan, everybody's been trying to figure out what to do. What is a national Jewish home? You know, how do we not prejudice the native inhabitants of the country, the Arabs? So they go and do everything that everyone else does. They go interview everybody, except for the Palestinian Arabs, who basically say everything that needs to be said has been said. By the way, I was struck. I was reading the Jerusalem Post today, and one of the leaders of the Palestinian Arabs today said, earlier today said, we don't need any more peace talks. Everything that needs to be said has been said. It's the same exact thing. It was really amazing. It really struck me. Seven members recommended the creation of an independent Arab and Jewish state with Jerusalem under international administration. Three members recommended the creation of a single federal state. Australia, which was part of the British Empire, abstained. Right? It's independent, but it's still in the Commonwealth. So, as people listened around the world, on November 29th, the UN General Assembly voted 33-13 with 10 abstentions in favor of the partition of the land of Israel. Now, we were speaking of David Browner a moment ago. Years ago, I read his autobiography called Soft Pretzels with Hot Mustard, I think is what it's called. And he talks about being a kid in Philadelphia in 1947 and everybody in the neighborhood going out that night in the streets and whooping it up because Palestine had just been declared a Jewish state. So that also tells you the impact of what this meant around the world. People listening on radios everywhere.
Sorry.
Yeah. In Brooklyn. Do you remember it? What do you remember?
No, I mean, I just remember, you know, just a lot of everybody very happy, a lot of celebrating.
Right. And it's...
And, you know, going out more with the Bushies. You know, fill them up.
It's often been said that that's the real day that the Jewish state was born. It wasn't May 15th, 1948. You know, Ben-Gurion, it's always confusing as to when Israel was born. Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence on May 14th, 1948, but it said, you know, the Jewish state will arise tomorrow or the next day. And so it was really May 15th, 1948. But it was the Arab. He had to do it then also because Shabbat was coming. It was 4 p.m. Friday afternoon, so he wasn't going to do it the next day because they had some religious people who signed it. All right, where are we? So people around the world listened. The Jewish community was obviously overjoyed. This also really started the War of Independence. You know, the five Arab armies might have invaded on May 15, 1948. However, the skirmishes with the Palestinians became increasingly stepped up, and indeed there were troops that came in from Syria that encamped themselves in the Galilee. And there was a lot of stepped-up operations, there was a lot of stepped-up skirmishing. The military situation for the Jews didn't look good. It didn't look good, but Ben-Gurion said we're going ahead anyway. He had been told by many people, you got a 50% chance of surviving this. He said, this is it, this is our moment. Weizmann from Europe said, go, declare the state of Israel. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The Jewish Agency obviously accepted the plan. Britain announced that it accepted it, but it refused to administer the Jerusalem Corridor. And the Brits did absolutely nothing to prepare the Arabs or the Jews for their evacuation. The Brits didn't coordinate anything. There was apparently some coordination with the Arabs in that they would tell them when they were leaving certain police fortresses called the Taggart fortresses, and the Arab irregulars would come take those fortresses, and then the Jews would have to have a battle with them. But there was a bad taste in everybody's mouth all the way around. So there's one moment left to discuss, and then we're going to get to some open-ended questions that deal with our course, and then we're going to hear from Rabbi Starr. One of American Jewry's finest moments in dealing with all this, and remember we talked about Abba Hillel Silver, came with the recognition of the State of Israel itself, which was really in jeopardy until 2 days before, until about May 13th. Truman, since 45, had said that he was against a religious state, what he called a religious state. It's not going to work, according to Truman. He wanted a state for all the inhabitants, which is something the Palestinians call for today. He feared that a religious state would lead to war. He didn't know it, but there already was a low-scale war that was only getting worse and would get worse in the next 3 years. 2 months before Israel's Declaration of Independence, Truman seemed to be going back on his acknowledgement of the need to partition the state. Remember, the United States had voted for partition in November 1947, but by January, and certainly by going into March, Truman had been beaten on by the State Department, led by Secretary of State George Marshall, who actually said to him at one point, if you recognize the State of Israel, I won't vote for you, which is an amazing thing to say to the President of the United States of America. If you ever want to read a great understanding of what happened there, Clark Clifford, who was the presidential advisor, has an autobiography, and his the third chapter in his book deals with this. And it's
He was the most supportive.
He was a political operative. He was in a domestic.
Exactly. But Truman listened to him, at least on this issue, and an unsung Jewish hero that we're going to get to in a moment too. Truman had also had it with the pressure of the Zionists. He listened to this. Harry Truman said in his autobiography, I do not think I had ever had as much pressure and propaganda aimed at the White House as I did in this instance. The persistence of a few of the extreme Zionist leaders disturbed and annoyed me.
You never heard of APAC.
This is Bob Hillel Silver, basically, rapping on his desk. Why did, after the partition agreement, the U.S. already had voted for the partition, why did Israel, the soon-to-be state of Israel, need the support of the United States? Any thoughts?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Why did the soon-to-be state of Israel need the support of the United States?
Financing.
Prestige,
absolutely. Help with diplomatic matters.
Perhaps the thinking was that then there would be assistance, there'd be military assistance, financial assistance, some of that didn't happen.
Right, yeah, we really didn't see military sales until the Kennedy administration in 62.
I mean, ultimately, what did it really matter? I mean, what would have happened differently if the U.S. had pulled off?
Well, here's one thing. There was talk that the administration might make it much more difficult to donate money to the state of Israel, you know, to raise money for a foreign country. So that's one thing for sure. But there's also heavy diplomatic influence that the United States can bring to the United Nations. And there's...
It's the same thing that Israel really needs right now is international legitimacy.
Right. And today the Palestinians announced they were going to apply to UN bodies because it's taken too long, the peace process. Yep.
Isn't it a big brother for protection?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ultimately, that's what you want. You know, what Israel ultimately wants is what's called a mutual defense treaty, right, which is laughable for the United States in some regards. But although Israel's intelligence is pretty formidable, you know, which means if you're attacked, we'll help you, and vice versa.
Some of that may have been there to preempt the Soviet Union.
Definitely. There was and that was part of Truman's ultimate reason why, part of Truman's ultimate reason why he recognized the State of Israel hours after it was announced.
Although the Soviets recognized Israel too.
Right. Stalin came, I think it's a day or two days later, I believe. But everybody knew that the Soviets were going to do that because Gromyko, who was their ambassador at the UN, had been cooperating, which surprised a lot of people. Now, why, by the way, did the Soviet Union want to cooperate with the soon-to-be state of Israel?
Socialist,
and, you know, it's also a way to get at the Brits and a way to get at the Americans. You know, put them in your orbit. It doesn't hurt. Although the Soviets undervalued the tensions between the Jews and the Arabs. But there was a couple months there when it was very, very valuable.
Brought also the United States a certain prestige.
Absolutely. And, you know, also there's a moral high ground that has always been a factor, not a deciding factor sometimes, but a factor in U.S. foreign policy. There's many things in which the United States gets involved, like Sudan in 93, which unfortunately didn't turn out well in some regards, but those were pure rescue and relief missions. They had nothing to do with our geopolitical interests, but they had to do with our moral political interests. All right. So let's see if we covered all those reasons. Oh, there was one other thing. Truman had developed an affinity for Chaim Weizmann. He liked the old man. He had told the old man that he was going to recognize the State of Israel. And he even said to one of his advisors at one point, after he overruled his State Department, which was still ignoring him until he had to read them the Riot Act, maybe the old man will believe me now. So I spent part of this morning looking at the Truman Library website. They have everything online. And, you know, and the thing you'll look at it tomorrow if you get a chance, I have some letters that Truman sent on the matter, which are really interesting.
Well, didn't his friend have more?
Eddie Jacobson. We're going to talk about Eddie right now, actually. Eddie Jacobson was someone that Truman was in World War One with. And after World War One, they opened up a haberdashery, a hat store, in Kansas City, Missouri together for about 3 years. The store didn't do so well. Truman did pretty well after that, but the store didn't do so well. Nonetheless, they maintained their friendship. And there was a dinner taking place in Boston. And David, I can get the exact name of the date in the hotel for you. You can look it up. It might be a plaque there or something, where Zionist leaders were giving an award to somebody, and one Zionist leader was saying to the other, you know, we just came from a meeting and we're having trouble with the president and we don't know what to do. And the one Zionist leader said, the other Zionist leader said, oh, I was just in Missouri, and I gave a B'nai B'rith award to this guy, Eddie Jacobson, who is friends with President Truman. I can get him on the phone, and he can maybe go see the president on our behalf. And the guy said, well, let's call him now. So they went to a phone, and they called Jacobson, and they said, when can you come meet me in Washington? I want to talk to you about this important issue. Oh, it was New York City. I want to talk to you about this important issue. And Jake, they made a date, and they got together. And Jacobson said, okay, I'll do it. And so Jacobson apparently was one of those people who could go to the White House and didn't need much of an appointment. And he went in to see Truman, and he raised the issue of the Zionists, and Truman wasn't happy. So Jacobson turns around, and this is what Jacobson writes later. I happened to rest my eyes on a beautiful model of a statue of Andrew Jackson, whom Truman revered. I then found myself saying to the president, almost word for word, Harry, all your life you had a hero. You are probably the best read man in America on the life of Andrew Jackson. Well, Harry, I too have a hero, a man I never met, but who is, I think, the greatest Jew who ever lived. I am talking about Chaim Weizmann. Truman apparently then looked Jacobson in the eye and said, you win, you bald-headed son of a beep. I will see him. So that is how the United States cemented its favoring of recognition for the State of Israel. And one of the things that we've done in this course is really tried to find these little vignettes to history that underlie these bigger issues. So now I'm going to ask you guys some questions. And let's see how much time we have. Do we want to take a quick break?
Dessert.
Want to have dessert and then do the questions?
Yeah, that's good.
We can do the questions while we're eating.
Yeah.
Cheers.